Now it's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight here on KPFT Houston.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Hank Rubicek, Communication Studies professor at the University of Houston downtown. And this morning, Brian, you know, Dwayne was so kind when he said that we're going to be talking about Out of the Hat, because my guest, Brian Connolly, a pianist, professor at Rice University and artistic director at Contest, is not going to be here this morning. So what we're going to do is to sort of play it by ear, no pun intended, and do a number of things that'll deal with storytelling. And I'm also going to address a few themes that some people, some listeners, have shared with me they'd like me to be able to develop. But right now, I wanted to tell Brian that we wish him the very best. He was ill this morning, and he told me all sorts of descriptive things that he was doing at 4 a.m., and believe me, I'm really glad he's not here. But out of the proverbial hat, you know, a cliche of old that represented what magicians did for entertainment, for shock value, for intrigue, and I'm no magician, but this morning I'm going to try to pull a few things out of the proverbial story hat to replace the original theme, Ballads to Babar, and it was very interesting and pretty intriguing. But you know, I'm gonna honor Brian by talking a little bit about the reason why this was the original theme. The reason is because the Romantic era was absolutely it when it came to putting together ballads and putting together beautiful story themes. We know that for many of us, a favorite story is in the form of a great ballad. Ella Fitzgerald's My Funny Valentine, They Long to Be Close to You by the Carpenters, for those of you over the age of 50 who like to slow dance, I Fall to Pieces by Patsy Cline, and what about Elvis? Lots of Elvis who just can't help falling in love, and maybe even in the ghetto. Ballads that tell beautiful stories that remain forever etched in our minds and heart. And we do, in fact, owe it to the Romantic period composers, those geniuses who reigned artistically circa 1815 to 1910, because these composers, Schubert, Schumann, Brahms, Poulenc, of Babar fame, crafted vivid tales through their large ensembles and extreme emotion that framed the Romantic compositions. You know, the classical period was in many ways the parent, and the Romantic period was the unruly child, because they broke all the rules of classical form. And as a result, the Romantics came to grips with some fabulous stories that we love and that we need to be able to embrace. And the Romantics will be showcased on October 28th at the next Context concert, which is a terrific series of chamber concerts. It's held at Rice's Duncan Auditorium, and it's at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you need to get to www.musicincontext.org in order to get some of the specifics, because you will not at all be disappointed. It's pretty marvelous. But you know, from ballads, and not unlike ballads, folk tales, as we know, as a very typical story genre, teach us about cultures and traditions, as well as important trends in artistic thinking, not unlike music, not unlike the Romantics, teaching us about differing beliefs and values and attitudes in order to solve a whole bunch of complex problems. One of my favorite folk tales comes from Joel Ben Izzy's The Beggar King and The Secret of Happiness, and it's entitled The Strawberry. Let me share it with you. A Zen master had traveled to a distant village, and he was running late for his return train. He decided to take what he thought was a shortcut. He found himself walking along a steep path, staring off into the distance. So taken was he by the beauty of the view that he did not notice where he was walking. At that instant, he kicked a small stone and, a moment later, realized that he did not hear it land. He stopped, only to discover that he stood atop a huge cliff. Another step, and he would have walked right off to a 100-foot drop below. As he stood there, gazing out of the mountains in the distance, he was suddenly shaken by a loud roar. He turned around to see a huge tiger slowly approaching. He took a step to the side, only to have the ground crumble beneath his feet. Falling off the edge of the cliff, heels overhead, his hands reached out to grab whatever might save him. An instant later, he found himself clinging with one hand to a thorny vine growing out of a crack in the rock. He looked up to the top of the cliff where he saw the tiger licking his lips. His eyes searched far below him to the bottom of the cliff. And there, looking up at him, waited a second tiger. With one tiger above and another below, he looked again at the vine, its sharp thorns cutting into his hand. And near the vine, he saw a tiny mouse crawl out. It scampered along a tiny ledge to the vine, looked at him for a moment, then looked at the tiger, and finally began to gnaw at the vine. Well, the monk searched for anything else he might grab, but there was nothing. Then, far off to the side, he spotted a tiny plant. Surely it was too small to hold his weight, but he reached for it just the same. It had green leaves, and as he parted them, he glimpsed something small and red. It was a wild strawberry plant, with one perfectly ripe strawberry. He plucked it from the plant and ate it. And as he did so, he thought, isn't life sweet? Eating a strawberry, you know, what a fool many people might think. He should have been looking for a way to save his life. And did any of these thoughts pop into his head? However, this folktale teaches us about Buddhist ideology. It really brings community together by teaching them how to become better decision makers by focusing on the priorities of life. Its premise is securely anchored in the present and the appreciation of the moment. From the story's account, the chance of escape for the young monk is impossible. And if the story were born from another culture, the conflict and ultimate solution could be viewed from an entirely different perspective. But here's a question that all of us need to ponder, especially from this kind of a story. Would another ideology create a story with a character having no way out? I don't know. Nevertheless, folktales can teach their listeners to scrutinize complex circumstances in which they may find themselves. Buddhist thought, advocates, and take a look at contemplations about life. And that's exactly what Buddhist ideology does. This folktale does just that. Folktales are passed down from one generation to another. And we know that folktales, being a very important genre, is one way for us to appreciate the art and in many ways the science of storytelling. The Romantics, the genre I talked about a little earlier, did that so well. We know that the Romantics did some fabulous things about creating lyrics and texts that created magnificent stories, being able to paint very rhythmic pictures. Folktales do that too. Music, folktales, both. Beautiful, beautiful forms of stories. You're listening to Out of the Proverbial Hat with Dr. Hank Rubichek, 90.1 KPFT Open Journal in Houston. And we're very glad that you're here. When we take a look at folktales, another way of viewing the importance of storytelling isn't just to understand what folktales teach us, but to understand the various compilations and different renditions of folktales. One is a fable, for example, and we know that fables typically consist of animals to personify the human condition. For example, a bear was once bragging about his generous feelings and saying how refined he was compared with other animals. There is, in fact, a tradition that a bear will never touch a dead body. A fox, who heard him talking in this strain, smiled and said, "My friend, when you are hungry, I only wish you would confine your attention to the dead and leave the living alone." The meaning of the bear and the fox is uncertain at best. Some fables have multiple layers of meaning, Indian tales, for example. Other types of fables with indirect lessons include the why or pourquoi stories. And short of an assigned parable, which is a designated use of language that is purposely intended to convey a hidden meaning other than contained in the words themselves, we know that fables can test the interpretive ability of his listeners. We love them. They teach us things. They give us lessons. They give us moral. that give us the kind of fabric that allows us to live our life well. But, you know, talking about fables, talking about folk tales, and even talking about music, in many ways, doesn't really hold a candle to the kind of personal narratives that so many of us heard growing up, the kind of stories that were shared by our families and our friends. Most of the open journal story times that we've done over the years have consisted of what I consider to be rhetorical heroes, people who've come in and disclosed incredible things about their lives, about losses, about strength, about discoveries. Just last month, David Rainey, an Ally actor, was here talking about his own perception about the death of his sister and how his sister, in so many ways, even through death, spoke to him and his family to such an extent that he believes she actually saved their lives. Pretty amazing when you think about it. But these are the sorts of things that just don't come from dreams. They come from individuals who teach us how to live lives. I oftentimes talk about my grandmother, who was the consummate storyteller. Rarely did she engage in dialogue or respond to a question without introducing a story, rich with tradition or wisdom, and sometimes both. Somewhere during the course of a conversation, if you spoke with her, she would tell the kind of stories that one typically finds in the most magical anthology of Eastern European folklore, the kind of stories that are designed to captivate the senses. Even if you asked her simple questions such as, what's for dinner? My grandmother would never say, well, we're having a brisket, or we're having soup, or we're even having bread. She would never say anything that simply. Instead, she'd give you a story. And she was smart because you had to sit there and listen to the story as long as it took. It was her way of engaging you, and it was your way of forcing how to listen. She would say, for example, after I asked her, what's for dinner? She'd say, well, you know, there was a little boy and his mother that attended a fair. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what in the hell does a fair have to do with dinner? But I love my grandmother, and I had to sit there and listen. That's what you do when you're seven. The mother, she continues, won a prize at the fair. It was a sofa. Well, she continues, the mother was happy, because she really needed one. She was told that the couch would be delivered in 3 months. When the young boy heard about the new sofa, he told his mother that he would jump on that couch all day and all night. Well, the mother, becoming a bit upset with her son, told him that he better not. Well, children are children, and as children, they like to aggravate their parents, my grandmother reminded. So, the little boy continued to tell his mother that he would jump and jump and as hard as he could on that sofa, try very hard to break it. Well, the mother became so angry with her son that she never talked to him again. And the sofa, it never came. Now, you know, I got to tell you, this story may not appear to be worthy of the Pulitzer Prize, but it did something more remarkable. It taught me something, and I remembered it. But what was more remarkable is that she would construct the story as it unfolded in her mind. She made up the whole thing right in front of me. The story belonged to her. And sometimes when I asked her a question in lieu of a story, she posed a seemingly philosophical remark designed to make a point. I'd ask her something like, do you like my girlfriend? And she would reply, well, I'm sure she didn't kill anybody. Puzzled, I'd ask her again, Grammy, do you like my girlfriend? And she'd respond similarly, well, I watched her eat and she can use a knife and fork. I continued a third time, but do you like her? Well, I was at the post office and I didn't see her picture up on the wall and I figured, okay, I got it. And then finally, she'd give me the parable. She's just okay. She's average. She's nothing special, but I'm sure she's a human being. That was her way of saying, I give her about a C, all right? But she couldn't just say that. She had to put it in story form. The first story, the one about the fair, Well, it took me a while to figure that one out. What did that have to do with dinner? Well, it had to do with the fact that if you ask questions and you make a big deal out of it, you sometimes just won't get dinner at all. Somehow, I didn't even get that connection, but frankly, what's the difference? Stories are things to remember. They are frozen in time, and sometimes they're just ready to thaw. And that's what we're doing this morning on KPFT Open Journal, Storytime with Dr. Hank Rubichek, and you're listening to Stories Out of a Hat. You know, this whole Yiddish folklore stuff is always fascinating to me. We talk about folklore, fables, we talk about culture. I just talked about my grandmother. There were also some wonderful stories that she told me, published stories, stories she didn't make up, that demonstrated the kind of wisdom that this folklore taught me and made so memorable. For example, sometimes when I talk to my students about the power of a word, I make it very clear to them that a word is arbitrary. It really doesn't mean anything until we do something with it. We can take any English sentence and we can make it mean whatever we want by emphasizing a word. I can take a sentence like, Jack, that's your sister Jill, and I can make it mean whatever I want by emphasizing the word. I can say, Jack, that's your sister Jill, which of course means that Jack has amnesia. Or I can say, Jack, that's your sister Jill. I can say, Jack, that's your sister Jill. I can say, Jack, that's your sister Jill. Or I can say, Jack, that's your sister Jill. Well, you get the idea. English is a crazy language, but the beautiful thing is we can take our voices and we can make it mean whatever we want. Well, my grandmother tried to make that point, but frankly, she wasn't that boring in doing it, not like me. Instead, she would tell me short Yiddish folk tales. For example, one was called Why Noodles Are Noodles. She told me that once someone asked Motka Chabad, it could be any name, but that one sounds good, right? The question, tell me, Motka, what is a smart fellow like you thinking when you think about why they call noodles, noodles? Well, he answered without hesitation. He said, what a question to ask. They're long like noodles, aren't they? They're soft like noodles, aren't they? And they taste like noodles, don't they? So why shouldn't they be called noodles? And I thought to myself, you know, you're right. They look like noodles. They sound like noodles. So why not call them noodles, right? Do we really have to have any other explanation? That's exactly what they look like. Sometimes she would tell me stories that did everything possible to confuse me. Sometimes she would tell me stories that would be, I suppose one would say somewhat insightful. But most of the time, they were just entertaining. And sometimes they were so entertaining that you remembered them and made meaning out of it. For example, she told me a story entitled You're As Old As You Feel. She said that there was a 40-year-old man who married a girl of 20. It caused a sensation in the social circle, as you might imagine. And once, when someone indelicately referred to the difference in their ages, the man replied, it's really not so bad. When she looks at me, she feels 10 years older. And when I look at her, I feel 10 years younger. So what's wrong? We're both 30. And that was the whole idea. I mean, after all, do we really care? Of course, I say that, and my son married a wonderful woman who's 16 years older, and that story would probably be ridiculous to him because 10 years is absolutely nothing to so many. You know, sometimes people ask, well, I can't tell a story. I want to be able to tell a story, and I hear about this all the time from people. They come up to me, you know, Dr. Hank, I want to know about a story. I want to know how to create a story. I've got great ideas. What do I do? Well, actually, it's a little bit easier than you might think, because most of the time we knew how to tell stories when we were children. Think about it. A really good storyteller is someone who has an idea. That's obvious. We get ideas from our journals, from photographs, from love letters, from books, ideas, from stories that we hear from others. We sometimes create stories from folk tales and fables, and we put our own topspin on it. But you know, one of the things that we have to remember is that when you've got an idea as long as you put it in some sort of coherent form, if it has a sense of chronology, if it's sequenced, it can make sense. But a 7-year-old has figured that out. I mean, a 7-year-old who wants to get out of going to school, sort of the Ferris Bueller type, but younger, would say something like, Mommy, I can't go to school today because I threw up all night. You didn't know that because I threw up really quietly. I didn't want to worry you. And I don't want to give you any kind of disease or anybody else any kind of illness, especially Miss Abrams, my teacher. Because if she gets sick, then we won't have a real teacher for a long time. And none of us like the substitutes. And she isn't very good, and I won't learn anything if that substitute does come in, so I better not go to school because I don't want to get Miss Abrams sick. And you want me to learn things, right? Now, it's a silly story, but frankly, when you think about it and you reduce that level of abstraction and you sort of think about it, it makes totally good sense. I mean, totally good sense. My question is, what happens when our children get to middle school and high school and they have to learn to write? They forget something. Because, see, a child knows that in order to make sense out of the world, you have to put it in story form and make it vivid, make it descriptive, make it persuasive, make it very convincing, but at the same time, it has to make sense. There has to be a sense of coherence. Let's say, for example, you go to your senior prom and you want to tell the story about your prom experience. Well, what would happen if you didn't put it in order? What if you said something like, no suspenders today. I'm a model for Calvin Klein underwear, and I couldn't wait to get to this reunion. Oh, yeah, those pants hiked up to my chin. Today, I feel proud. No asthmatic inhaler in my front pocket today. I didn't want to go to my last high school reunion because I didn't have any confidence. Those last 2 years in high school were terrible. Now I do. I was scrawny. And those clips on the suspenders, you know the kind, had those large brass clips holding up my pants. I wasn't exactly athletic. I hadn't yet overcome those laughs. I was never chosen for kickball either. Now, if you're thinking that's choppy, that's ridiculous, you're right on every conceivable account. But frankly, that's how so many people write, and that's how so many people think. What if you take the details of a story, any story, and what if you simply listed it, just like a grocery list, and then numbered each detail as it occurred? And then you put those details in sentence form. Suddenly, you've got continuity. You have a sequence. You have a transition. So instead of what I just shared with you, what if I were to say, you know, I didn't want to go to my last high school reunion because I hadn't yet overcome the laughs that came my way every day during my last 2 years of high school. And considering how I looked, laughs were all I expected. I mean, I was scrawny and needed to wear my pants hiked up to my chin, held firm by those cheap suspenders. You know, the kind with big brass clips latched onto your pants. Oh, it got worse. I used to carry one of those asthmatic inhalers in my shirt pocket. Needless to say, I wasn't seen as the athletic type. Hey, would you choose me on your kickball team? I didn't think so. I lost my confidence at every turn during those years, but today I feel proud. I couldn't wait to attend this reunion. After all, I'm a model for Calvin Klein underwear. Oh, yeah, no suspenders today. Well, in that kind of story, whether we like it or not, at least we were able to understand it. And being able to understand a story is what is so very, very critical. I wanted to thank all of you to listen, and I want all of you to think real, real, real carefully about coming to the monthly story swap for the Houston Storytellers Guild. And when you do that, you're going to really become a fabulous story. Go to www.houstonstorytellers.org to find out all the great events, especially Skyline Screamers, the Saturday before Halloween. Be scared. Be really scared. In the meantime, thank you so much for tuning in. Be generous with our fall drive. Starts tomorrow. Please, we can't do it without you. And remember, it's never too late to live happily ever after. See you next month.